Hello, everybody. Welcome to Leftology again after another, what, 4 month hiatus. Hopefully you're enjoying the Anti-Oedipus reading group series that I'm using to maintain this channel's life at all. But today I'm gonna bring in, I guess you can go ahead and introduce yourselves. So I don't know if I can do it justice.
Hi, I'm John. I'm Brenda Cam, new friend. I met Cam through Taylor Adkins, who runs Machinic Unconscious Happy Hour, tipped me out to the Anti-Oedipus reading group, and we connected, and we just started talking, bitching about various, like issues in academia, problems of theory, other people not reading as many books as we do, blah, blah, blah. So. And then he invited me to be on the pod, and I said, okay, sure. And
Yeah,
here we are.
I kind of want to use the podcast for more casual conversation. Sorry if you guys can hear like the thunderstorm happening in the background there. But I guess what I wanted to get over today was, as we discussed before we started recording, kind of like what is theory? Because that's kind of the aspect of philosophy that I've always been interested in ever since I really got into it my sophomore year of college 2 years ago now. And I just went I went the a speed run route of theory basically, and then turned around and I was like, wait, only 5% of all philosophy jobs apply to what I do, so maybe I should probably talk to some other people about what this I guess subfield of philosophy really is. So I think that's a good kind of first discussion question would be, what is theory? Or one of the six, I guess, questionnaire. How is theory? Why is theory? Where is theory?
When is theory? Not now. Yeah, so
Maybe in the future. Maybe theory will be good again.
yeah, man. So I thought I've been thinking about this for a few days, and I kept coming back to a quotation from Fred Jameson's recent, I think most recent book called Allegory and Ideology, which is a kind of end of career opus that he put out a few years ago, kind of trying to synthesize his biggest ideas from Marxism and Form. What's the other ones? Political Unconscious, Postmodernism, and Antinomies of Realism. So it's this kind of huge sort of synthetic project. But it opens, or one of the early chapters opens with this really helpful image that has clarified for me what it is that I do, and how it is that I do what I do. So it's a little bit long, but do you mind if I read it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, this is from Allegory and Ideology. It is a vast and ill-lit basement intersected by pipes of all sizes, of various materials, in various states of de deterioration, without obvious passageways, and obstructed by tanks and storage containers of all sizes, each one of which, pipes and tanks alike, sporting dials and glass panels of equal variety, whose registers, clocks, meters, thermometric pressure gauges, numerical scales, quadrants, warning lights, and calibrations are in constant surveillance by the innumerable historians in their white coats and checkboards, jostling one another as they jockey for a look or sneer at their neighbors. No one knows how many kinds of measurements are in play, nor even the antiquity of some of the devices, each of which registers the variable rates of different indicators, such as water pressure, temperature, instability, consumption, luxury goods, life expectancy, annual film production, salinity, ideology, average weight, average heat, church attendance, guns per family, and the rate of extinction of species. Those who have concluded that these tasks are meaningless sit against the wall in various states of fatigue. Others race frantically back and forth to invent a master statistic that might encompass all these random findings, while still others concentrate stubbornly on their own calculations and substitute their own algorithms, which may or may not have any relation to those of their neighbors. None of these dials registers history directly, of course. It exists somewhere outside this basement, and all the dials seem to record it in one way or another. You could certainly call it an absent cause or an untotalizable totality if you think it exists. But no one has ever seen anything but the gauges and their needles, the numbers and their rise and fall, which vary wildly and require separate monitors. Despite this, there persist the occasional joint cooperative efforts, along with the most unsubstantiated generalizations and a tacit conviction, if not mutual agreement, that there must be something or other out there. So that, to me, gets at the essence of what it is that we do. History theory is a discourse, it's an activity, it's a mode of thinking, reading, and writing that attempts to locate certain objects of analysis within a historical totality, that tries to take the world not as a bundle of disconnected facts, such as how liberal historicism might, or how new historicism, or how any of these sort of mainstream approaches to cultural objects or sociological history do, but that try to take every fact and every point within a totality in relation to that which is outside it. It must be historical, it must be dialectical, and it must have a sense of both signification and the unconscious. Those, to me, are the four points that define something as theory: history, dialectic, signification, unconscious. I realize this is kind of a narrow definition to some people, but
outside of Hegel dialectic, right?
Well, I mean dialectic not in the sense of, like, you know, Althusser's, you know, Hegelian reading of history or anything like that, like, or what Althusser says Hegel says. I don't mean that in terms of, like, diamat, Soviet, Stalinist dialectical materialism. I mean it in terms of, like, just the idea that any fact is only understandable if you understand its total context. Every fact is inseparable from its total context, and the effort of thought is to place things within that absolute horizon, which is impossible, like, which we can't do, but the work of theory is to try to build models and graphs and systems and measurements and register those relationships. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like... So I guess Foucault comes to mind here, because I remember it was a TikTok on Foucault that I saw, like, a year or so ago, and it was kind of like asking Foucault where his thesis statement was, and I'm like, there isn't one. It's the fact that there's 1,000 cases that prove the same point, or prove right. This historical totality. One of Foucault's themes, I think, is that, maybe this is on or off topic, it's that if there's no meaning behind any suffering, but we're at the heart of it always. That's probably his biggest theme throughout everything. But there's actually, I don't know if there's a single work by Foucault that theme does not penetrate at least once.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess between them trying to offer this history case by case of how human society, or this particular aspect of human society, is built up through these either customs or norms or this means of control or power, etc. It's not the fact that he has an argument for it. He's just showing you the cases and hoping that you'll kind of figure out the totality on your own to some degree.
And what Foucault's interested in tracking is, Deleuze says this in his book on Foucault, Foucault is really interested in two things. He's interested in statements, and he's interested in dispositifs or apparatuses, right? And he's interested in the ways that almost imperceptibly those two things shift. How over the course of the 18th into the 19th century, the kinds of statements one can make about natural species, about political economy, about mathematics, etc., like how the kinds of statements we can make changes at an almost, in a way, almost like evolution. I'm not describing it as evolution, but it's a similar mechanism, like slow creep, and then all at once, bam, you know, the example that comes to mind is statistics, right? The first statistical tables of populations measuring the rate of suicide emerges in the late 16th, early 17th century in England. This as a method of sort of keeping an eye on populations, of getting a sense of how many are being born, how many people are dying, who's paying taxes, you know, if when people are dying, what are they dying of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? That practice begins in England in the 1600s. I mean, it happens in China also much earlier than that, but like in the West and in Europe, it begins in these statistical tables. That's continued, that sort of propagates into France, into Prussia, into all these places. But in 1845, Alphonse Quetelet comes up with the concept of the average man, where he says the average man is the man of statistics, is the one that I write into the statistical table when I, you know, in the sense of like how many people committed suicide by jumping off a bridge, 17. That the average man is the unit of statistics, and he becomes a new kind of historical figure. He becomes utterable. There is no average man before Quetelet conjures him into being, even though he had an effective existence in the statistical table for hundreds of years prior. Does that make sense?
Yeah, he wasn't seen by the forces of power, I guess. He becomes real when he becomes real to the state, to some degree.
He becomes articulated. Yeah, he is real in a sense, but he is produced as a statistical fiction. He's articulated at this particular moment in 1845 when Quetelet publishes. I forget what the book is called. I should know. I was writing it about it in my dissertation. But when Quetelet publishes a particular book, he introduced the concept of l'homme moyen, or average man.
Oh,
so but I guess what I'm trying to say here is that this is how Foucault operates, by like the infinite set of cases that are all the same, that all sort of speak to a similar regime, that all connect up to a similar apparatus, you know, the disciplinary society, the biopolitical regime, the medical apparatus, etc. But at the same time, he's tracking the tiny, minute differences and differentials between each of those points. And looking for what he calls the statement, which is this almost like oracular break from previous statements where a new thing is said. And that's theory to me in a huge way. It's about tracking how the ways we see the world are suddenly flipped, how a new sort of flash of light happens in the clearing. And a new facet of the world becomes illuminated, to sort of like steal from Heidegger. And Foucault was a Heideggerian.
Yeah, I can see it at least in the aletheia term of things for Heidegger, that Foucault would be that. Because I think it literally just clicked kind of why Foucault starts Madness and Civilization with kind of that discussing lepers and the transition of the leper facilities to I guess the madhouses in the like early Renaissance, the transition into like having institutionalized centers for what the state deems are mad. And it kind of seems that Foucault is telling us, it's like you see over there that Hindu culture has these untouchables, and they call them untouchables, but if you come over here to Europe, we also have an untouchable. They used to be lepers, but now they're the madmen. And we just really, really don't like saying that we also have this untouchable group in society, because we're the ones that we've created them, and we've maintained their system, or we've maintained the system of oppression that keeps them in their place. and maintains our relation to such types of people.
Right. And that's like a kind of a clash between two different apparatuses, right? The colonial apparatus that says that separates the European man from the sort of from the Indian or from like the from the Eastern man. On one hand, that introduces that ideology that says, like, you know, you are free because they are enslaved. And the carceral apparatus, right? That sort of, and the medical apparatus. So it's this sort of meeting between really the three major, I guess, subjects that Foucault deals with. Madness is such a perfect, it's about incarceration, it's about medicine, and it's about colonialism, like his sort of three central themes.
Foucault becomes increasingly popular, even though I don't know if I'll ever write on him. I think his writings will be useful in like another way, I guess. But I guess the side point was, I don't know if there's a single day where it doesn't seem that the politics of at least disability or those that are deemed less able to some degree by the state apparatus, I don't know if there's a single day where it doesn't become more important to understand that type of politics. Because it is kind of Foucault naturally, or not naturally, he hates nature. Foucault finds that like the West has just kind of drawn the line between human and non-human and hasn't included persons only on one side of that thing or on one side of that line. There is a point where humans or whatever you want to call them, can be deemed non-human by this apparatus of power and kind of taken their autonomy away from. And you can argue whether Foucault is a moralist or not, but that's not necessarily something we want happening, whether we want to agree that there is some universal moral system or not. That's kind of a sidetrack, but it is kind of just, I remember, I forget if it was Acid Horizon or Machine Can Conscious, because they blend together way too much, especially when I haven't listened to the episode in a while. But the point that I heard on them, half a year, maybe a year ago or more, they had a Foucauldian on that wasn't Will from Acid Horizon, discussing what teaching Foucault is like, because that's where I think I started with him. Was because from that podcast episode, I learned that Foucault's not about the thesis statement. It's not about this argument. He's not trying to convince your like conscious mind of anything. He's trying to convince your eyes to see differently.
Right. No, and he's giving you a tool, right? It's the Deleuzian point of like a book is a weapon.
Yeah.
Right. Which they took from George Jackson. That like a... And I do think, you know, for better or worse, that this goes back to his sort of Heideggerian leanings, that like what philosophy does is it illuminates a new section of being for you. You stand in the world and you're able to suddenly see something. I taught when I was a TA, I'm not right now, I'm finishing my dissertation. I do not have time to teach. But like when I was a TA, I taught YA literature, like a class on children's lit. And we read one novel, the title of which I'm forgetting, which was a sort of high school romance, you know, like the kind of which there are hundreds, thousands.
Yeah.
Right? That's sort of like, and the way we taught it was through Foucault, presenting the school as a disciplinary apparatus. And let me tell you, there is nothing more fun to teach than to explain to a bunch of 19-year-olds the Panopticon for the first time. Like to draw it on the board and go through the whole thing and to look around the room and see them all go, oh shit, this is you know, like to have them say like, you know, the prisoners, I mean, we don't need to go into it, but like, you know, they're like, the prisoners never know when they're being watched, so they watch themselves, and that this is the plot of, in many ways, of almost every high school film, of almost every sort of high school book, of like these sort of network of gazes. Everybody is watching themselves being watched by others who are watching, like, you know, and to see them and to see these kids, many of whom are highly privileged, some of whom aren't, see that illuminated for themselves for the first time. You know, it's almost trite. We joke about it on Twitter now, like, oh yeah, the prison, everything's a prison, this is a prison, that's a prison, you know, the Oprah meme, you get a prison and you get a prison and you get, like that's sort of how it feels for somebody who has spent their life reading this stuff. But like, to for a young undergraduate to encounter that for the first time, it's totally mind-blowing. It's totally, and it can be life-changing. And that, I guess, is gets me back to Jameson, you know, who says, you know, history is what hurts, right? That's the great line from Political Unconscious. And theory is a way of naming our hurt, of coming to terms with our hurt, of saying why, you know, who hurt me and why, and how do I, you know, not heal it? There's no healing. Like, we're wounded, you know, and we live in the wound. We are the wound. We are nothing but the wound of history. But, you know, how can I get a grip on it? How can I gain the slightest amount of agency more than I had yesterday? And to do that every day. That I see that as my job in a lot of ways, like as a professor in a dying field, or as a TA and perhaps future professor in a dying field. Like, you know, no, I, you know, these kids, I hope that they learn to love George Eliot and Herman Melville or whoever else. I love them. I hope that they do too. But more than that, I see my job as like giving them a weapon to deal with a world that has hurt them and will continue to. You know, that's, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good transition to kind of like, to saying it's a dying field. I really hope not, because I'm 6 years behind you. So I really hope there's professor jobs there when I enter the field in like 2031 or something.
There will be jobs. They just won't be good. But they're not good now, so who cares?
I hope they get better. Yeah. But I guess a big thing for me, I guess if we can turn our gaze towards academia, would be kind of the numbers game that has become like majoring in college to a degree, at least at an undergraduate level. Graduate school is slightly less. But I guess to go through like the history that you get told for politics and analytic philosophy, to really, I guess, to set the stage before we even get into neoliberalism, is because you kind of hear that like by the 50s and 60s with the student, I guess, revolts in the time, Adorno, Marcuse, and the people who do critical theory, or people associated with them, or even existentialism, because Sartre was a communist, mm-hmm. Or associated with it.
Sartre was a Stalinist. He, yeah. You know, an unrepentant,
the worst Stalinist. Kind.
Yeah, I mean. I mean, his Stalinism is incredibly interesting and important for his reception, but whatever. This is a hobby horse of mine, but go on.
Yeah, but it does kind of, from the little bit I know of, at least early analytic, that like 20s, 30s, 40s era of it, like to get to the 50s and 60s during the McCarthy trials and the wake of the Red Scare, and to see kind of analytic philosophy be picked out as this kind of like depoliticized aspect of philosophy, mm-hmm. is very weird. Like I know I'm on Twitter as like the number one hate of analytic philosophy, or number one hater of analytic philosophy, like the pure continental, if there was one. But it almost does kind of seem disappointing, because you have figures like Bertrand Russell, who lived till what, the 1960s or something, and he was a staunch socialist his entire life. So where, yeah. Most of the other people who are around for the Vienna Circle and other stuff, and even though I think their stuff is incredibly boring, at least they had some spine. I think we're at a point where analytic philosophy isn't depoliticized quite as much anymore, especially with the advent of feminist politics, or not feminist politics, feminist philosophy in like the 70s through the 90s, really kicking up in England and America. Mm-hmm. But I guess the long tirade of history, I think I want to get to with like analytic being the 90% of the field now, if not slightly more, right. Is kind of, it seems that at least what the algorithm gives me on social media, a lot of people are trying to play this, like I said, a numbers game with majoring in college, where they go in, whether they're good at it or not, into this field that may make them $130,000 a year. At an average, they're looking at the long game rather of their like wallet more than what they can kind of do to give themselves a better outlook in the world. Because as my one of the philosophy professors in my department explained, before he left, earlier this year, was that there's kind of this difference between the humanities and STEM, and it's like STEM can be really good in about one job or a subfield of jobs if you only do STEM. But if you do a humanities major, what you're going to learn is to kind of appreciate thinking in one way or another. And a lot of people can call that an excuse to really enjoy this dying field that is the humanities side of any university. But I do think there is to a degree that it is true, because even in my own life, I feel happier to one degree or another. Actually being able to like analyze the world that I live in, which is not something you really get to do as a chemistry major, or especially a business major, when you have to draw inside the lines to get 100 in your class.
So like there's a whole history to this, right? And I mean, I am not a historian of labor. I wanted to be for actually a little bit, but I sort of backed down from that route for a number of reasons. But I will say that to major in, say, STEM or today is, as I understand it, quite different than it would have been, say, you know, several decades ago, pre-1970s. There's a kind of professionalizing and job training aspect to it. You are being trained very much to perform a certain task, to work in a certain job. Often professors in given departments will have projects that relate to sort of stuff that given companies are doing, and there's a sort of a pipeline established for you. I mean, I don't begrudge, I mean, I came from a working class background. I don't begrudge anybody their right to get theirs. I mean, at a certain point, you know, to sort of, if you come, well, maybe I do begrudge them a little bit, but.
Don't be a class traitor, but get the bag.
I'm not a class. I mean, what I guess I mean is like, I try not to moralize decisions like that, that my own students have made, that my friends have made, that my colleagues have made. It's not for me. It's not something I have the skill set to do, and it's not something I have the stomach for. What I will say is that technical training, especially in the case of business schools, much of what you learn in business school is stuff that you would have been taught on the job, like several decades ago. You would have learned it on the job. You had just been taught it by like your superior in like 3 weeks. And they have tricked now two or three generations of young people into paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for what they would have learned on the job in 3 weeks, a few years, like, you know, several decades ago. It's like what professional football does with college football. Like, you know, rather than support a minor league where the teams are paying the players, et cetera, they just let the colleges train the players, and then they draft them once they're out of college. That is essentially what like many American corporations have done with business school, quote unquote, whatever that even means anymore. The MBA, I mean, I don't know the history of the MBA. The MBA, not the NBA. but it's hard for me sometimes, because I want them to sit down and say, well, you know, teacher, professor, whoever, you've shown me all this, my eyes are open, I'm gonna, you know, change my life. I realize that this path I'm on is not going to make me happy, that making six figures a year is not going to make me happy, that, like, you know, sort of becoming a lawyer like my dad is not going to make me happy. And I want it for them. I want that for them. But I can't fight it. You know, all I can do is give them, as, you know, in my position as a graduate student, as a TA, as not even really a mentor, I don't have advisees or anything like that, all I can really do is say, hey man, like, here's some resources. I had a student once, I don't think he would mind if I told this story. He was probably the best student I ever had. Brilliant. He wrote, he was in my children's lit class. He wrote an amazing kick-ass paper about children's picture books, black children's picture books from the 60s, and just sort of how they presented blackness and whiteness, and, you know, cultural, and like, it was a fantastic paper. He did readings of images, readings of text, readings of publication history, etc. Great kid. The last day of class, he asked me if he can walk with me to my car. And I say, yeah, sure. Like, let's talk. Like, what's up, man? And he's like, oh, can you give me some stuff? You know, give me some things, some thinkers, some philosophers, some political theorists, some folks to look at and think with, because I'm interested in activism and all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, yeah. And I said, let me think about it. And I wrote him like a 6-page email with like a dozen books in it and summaries of each of the books. I got so freaking excited because I love this stuff. And I want, like, it was, you know, a student who actually cared. And I said, yeah, this is amazing. And he sent me an email back that was like 2 paragraphs that was basically like, hey man, thanks for this. Do you have any good YouTube interviews with these guys? Because I don't really have time to read these books. And that hurt. You know, I wasn't like personally offended, but I was sort of depressed by that. And I said, yeah. And I sent him the Foucault-Chomsky debate and just let him have it. But, you know, I don't know what you'd do. Especially with a generation, multiple generations of students who come up after 2008 that are told to be pragmatic, who are told that philosophy and English and comp lit and foreign language and all this stuff will never get you a job, that it's a major for dummies. Like, I really think that one John Mulaney special, like, killed the English major worse than almost anything else in some way. You know, it's hard. How do you convince these students that this stuff matters? And increasingly, the students who do major are from private schools, are, you know, have academic parents or highly educated parents, are people who have been primed to be a kind of cultural elite. And that depresses me. I want my working class kids to read this stuff and not see themselves in, I think that's a fucking awful expression, but to see how this is their world too. And it's hard. It just is hard, you know. It's not discouraging. I'm not discouraged. I still love the work, but it's does this all make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm kind of the I guess at least on the continental side, the guy that does like philosophy, par philosophy in my department, like just kind of does the readings and then does my own little readings on the side as well. So I get, I mean, not from a teacher's perspective, but I get the, see the other philosophy majors, not necessarily on that level. There's a lot, or of the few we have in my department, there's a lot of people that literally genuinely care, but are kind of stuck by the fact that they kind of do want, they don't have the time to go to doctoral school or get a master's in philosophy, at least as the first one. Or as their first graduate degree, maybe some when they're like 30 or 40 down the line or something. But there's a lot of people that I see that I'm like, you have a lot of potential for this. Like you're really great. I like discussing in class with you these things. If you just didn't want to be like a lawyer, you could be this great professor, even though I imagine you're probably also going to be a great lawyer. This is the whole other thing. I don't want to dig myself a hole. Because there's, I have classmates that are generally going to do probably good things, be like a green environmentalist lawyer or something like that. People that generally care about all these issues that are going into these other fields. And I'm glad they're not adding supply to the job market for philosophy. But it at least as like a self-interested somebody who wants that job in 6-7 years.
Yeah. And remember that, you know, the academy is not the only place where philosophy happens.
Yeah, yeah.
The academy, especially not the only place where theory happens. People love theory. More people are reading theory now than ever because of things like Zero and Repeater because of like certain series. Yeah,
I started with capitalist realism, so it was Zero books that got me into philosophy.
Yeah, and I mean, Mark Fisher produced, he produced a lot of things, but he produced a generation of bloggers and many of those blogs are kind of bad. And like
most statistically have to be.
Yeah, like, of course, right? Like, but like the fact, like, he is a kind of electrifying writer. He's not right about everything. He's not, you know, his sort of sympathies with land that in my opinion, sort of stuck around to the end almost, are disturbing. But he produced a kind of discourse and a kind of writing that is the best of what theory can do.
Yeah.
To take objects and put them in their context and to show how there's this reciprocal action between them.
That was kind of the, I guess I got an intense feeling of that reading Post-Capitalist Desire from Repeater, because you read it and you get his, I don't know what it would be at the end of the book, if it's just kind of like a little paragraph or two on what his students did after he died, because he died in the middle of a lecture series during the winter break between the, I guess, the fifth and sixth lecture, I think.
Yeah.
And you kind of get this feeling, it's like, this great thinker is gone, but also, are we stuck here now because he's gone? Like, what would the other four lectures, what other four or five lectures would have provided us? Like, I almost started tearing, not just because all this like great theory was gone, but also because you could really feel that a person was gone, even within the pages of that own book.
Yeah.
You could feel like somebody who genuinely cared about those students was just not in the world anymore.
There is a, reading those pages after having taught theoretical text to undergraduates, and I believe his students are master's students, but still same difference, we're all stupid. It was this, how do I say this, it was, you can feel him almost wanting to pick up the students and shake them, like, why can't you get this, this is like, you know, Lukács, you know, just like he, like, caring so much and just wanting every single person in that room to understand what he's saying and to get the import of it for their day-to-day lives, which is, I think, the best thing a professor can do, is to model a certain kind of life. I've thought this often, like, you know, the things you remember from your great professors is very rarely a lecture, unless it's one or two very great lectures, but it's about a whole style of living and of thinking and of sort of a form of life. And I don't mean like wearing tweed and sort of like smoking cigarillos and, you know, being a, I don't mean like that stuff, but I mean like, oh God, like, you know, be like an intelligent person who's willing to give things up, to like give up certain material comforts to pursue a thought. You know, my advisor, my primary advisor, gave me, I took a class with him, Russ Leo, who is an amazing early modernist, Spinozist. He's writing a book on anti-psychiatry right now, he's an amazing guy. But when I took my first class with him on Spinoza and Spinozism and like sort of post-Marxist Spinozisms, he gave me a new model of how to be a thinking person, of like how to confront life every day. Not philosophically, like not like a sort of Seneca sort of that, but like how to take things and sort of turn them on their head and always see the more interesting side of whatever you're encountering. The guy loves X-Men for some reason. I still don't really understand why he loves X-Men, but like, you know, or like that to me was, you know, nothing in particular that he said, and not even any of his ideas or any of his sort of theses or whatever. He's not that kind of teacher, but just this style of dealing with the world that's not tortured, that's not overwrought, that's not sort of distant, that's not angry, but also not sort of passive. It was eye-opening for me, and I try to emulate that in my own way. He'd be so fucking embarrassed if he ever saw this interview. Jesus Christ. Russ, turn off the camera. But yeah. Yeah. I do believe that that is what, and I mean, that can also take ugly forms. Like, you know, everybody's known a professor who like maintains this weird cult of personality around himself, and it's always a himself.
Yeah.
You know, which is a whole other thing. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about just like a model for life, for a better way of living. You know, I don't think that that's too much to ask.
Yeah, it is a very.
It should pay me more to do it, but that's not too much to ask. What?
Yeah, it is a very interesting way to go into philosophy, because it kind of, I don't know, the continental side just seems to get at that at least more, if not purely that side, because it kind of seems like we do have these arguments, like Anti-Oedipus has this argument, like mm-hmm. it has this like thing against Freud. It wants to prove that Oedipus has all these other consequences, that it's not, I'm just saying it because it's right here, mm-hmm. it has all these consequences, and these what contingent structures that build it up. But by the end of the book, you get this way of living, this way of viewing how you've been formed as a human that is completely different than before, mm-hmm. because the Nietzscheanism, and I guess to a degree the Spinozism also, because Deleuze kind of doesn't really separate the two as a tradition. They're kind of both the tradition of a weird rationalist irrationalism.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense within the continental world, I believe, but to nobody else, that would be like, what the hell are you talking about? But there's this kind of way of living where Deleuze gives you, Deleuze and Guattari combined, don't forget Guattari, he's important too, they give you this way of living that isn't about meaning, and it kind of does help with the past. Especially with kind of the anti-psychiatry that they end up doing with schizoanalysis, in that what you are, even if you're on the periphery of whatever the body is, or the full body is, mm-hmm. You are contingently made up of what functions. It is kind of a Darwinism to some degree. Which I may or may not, we may have gotten into the reading groups a little bit. Kind of what I was getting on is like, we form out of what functions. That's kind of the view that I get out of Anti-Oedipus. There's not really a meaning behind it, just like we discussed with Foucault. There's no real true meaning to all the history of human suffering, just like there's no meaning to the suffering that formed us of who we are. Mm-hmm. Deleuze kind of personalizes it, at least in my view. But the theory offers us a way of, I guess, going back on our past and viewing what has come out of it is not this, we're not the end of ourselves, I guess, in some way. Like, this is right. not the Cameron that would have always been made out of any events. There's some, if things had gone differently in 2017, 2018, I would not be studying philosophy.
Right.
I might be a right winger because of just what I was in. Like the social media platforms I was viewing on social media, not too far, hopefully. I don't like to think of all the other contingent features because they're kind of,
no,
I'm just like, glad I'm not there.
This is exactly, I mean, for me, like the exact experience you're describing is what I sort of experienced when I read Freud for the first time, because Freud, and via Lacan, and not just Lacan, but also Bion and say Melanie Klein, like all of these writers, they are obsessed, in a way, and horrified by how active the force of contingency is in our lives. How ridiculous is it that, you know, I'll use the example, like my father. You know, my father had a bad experience at a doctor when he was like 4 years old. You know, I think he got a tooth pulled or like he had some kind of bad experience at a doctor. And from that point on, he hated doctors. From the moment he didn't have to see a doctor again, he wouldn't go. And, you know, 40 years later, you don't see a doctor. You know, you you're going to croak. And he did. And he got sick and he died of a cancer that he could have, did not have to die of. Mostly because he was traumatized at a young age by an event that probably wouldn't have even been traumatic if it had been a month later or a month earlier. Like the stupidity of our lives, like the stupid fact of chance and the dice roll that has not just the butterfly effect, but just has this, you know, that I am the product, you know, I'm also the producer, but I am the product of what was done to me. And the question that Deleuze wants us to answer, I think, is a totally psychoanalytic question, which is, what will you do with what has been done to you? How will you claim it as your own?
Yeah,
this is all over Guattari. Yeah,
I guess coming from Deleuze and Guattari's take on psychoanalysis, more than necessarily just to forgive psychoanalysis of its crimes or something. I remember writing in one of my Being and Nothingness papers for my history class this last semester, I was writing on like how bad Sartre's understanding of psychoanalysis was, and some parts, points I'd give him to, just if he's talking like Melanie Klein or something, like that aspect of psychoanalysis, it does give in to Sartre's critique that psychoanalysis just pulls away from the fault of the individual. But with kind of Deleuze's, it is more Deleuze than Guattari, this one, but his Spinozism and to some degree his Nietzscheism, kind of with Spinoza, there's a contingency, but there's also a necessity to that contingency, which is the weird part of it.
Right. And this is the early modern aspect of Spinoza.
But because it's coming from Spinoza and nowhere else, Deleuze kind of avoids what Sartre is critiquing in the absence of fault in psychoanalysis. Because what Sartre says is, you can always get to this, the unconscious, you can always get to this drive that absolves fault of the individual or the ego or whatever. And I don't really think Deleuze, having read Sartre definitely by this point, I mean, he mentions Critique of Dialectical Reason in what I read today. If you can get through that, you can get through Being and Nothingness. Just logically speaking there. But schizoanalysis is able to avoid this whole from its Spinozism, I guess, in my interpretation at least, because I don't know if blessedness is the right term for Spinoza. You would know better than me. Blessedness was the term I found online for it. But Spinoza has this idea that you are contingently made, but knowledge is this kind of level of, not necessarily above contingently made, but it grants you something greater than just being this contingent process. Because everything you do in Spinoza's world is the result of all these different forces combining. There's no like necessary freedom to it. There's no free will in it necessarily. But if you do end up somehow on Spinoza's route, the ability to look back through science, philosophy, etc., and understand the forces that made you up, there's a degree to where you regain that autonomy that is lost in the necessity of that contingency.
Yeah, no, like you, it is an extremely, it's an extremely psychoanalytic point, I think. Yeah, like an existential point. And I mean, this is probably where, you know, I'm trying to think of where to go with this. So Spinoza is perhaps the most unlikely candidate to be the great philosopher of joy. To be like, the man's life was in many ways a living nightmare. He was excommunicated. You know this, right? He was excommunicated from his Jewish community.
Yeah, I just read the Deleuze's introduction to his book on Spinoza, where he goes over he's excommunicated after learning from radicals and then interpreting their view of religion. Somebody comes and stabs him, and then he just keeps the garment for the next 30 years of his life.
Yeah.
He dies in, what, his early 50s?
He dies in his early 50s from lung ailments because the way he supports himself, he can't participate in his family's shipping business. And the way he supports himself is by grinding lenses, like for microscopes. And he's reportedly one of the best lens grinders in Europe. He's very precise, but he inhales glass dust for decades. And he dies. He basically suffocates. His lungs just stop working. But on top of that, like, this is a man who saw his friend, the prime minister of the Netherlands, what was effectively the prime minister, they have a slightly different title, was a friend of his. And he was torn limb from limb in the streets by an angry mob and eaten. Him and his brother, they were by a sort of royalist mob. There was tensions in the Dutch Republic for a complex set of reasons. And this guy, who was one of Spinoza's last, you know, friends and defenders in public life, torn limb from limb and eaten by an angry, you know, like, and this is a man who, after that, writes the Political Treatise, writes the great document of democracy.
Incomplete document on democracy.
Exactly. Like, you know, I mean, Negri would say, you know, isn't its completeness in its incompleteness, something like that. But, you know, like, yeah, no, it's, there is a kind of, and of course, like, much of this is aspirational, much of this is a pose that he puts on. There is a style to the ethics and to the Morae Geometrico, though he denies that it's a style. He says this is math. It's not fucking math. You know, like, it's not like, you know, if you ever read the ethics, you are totally.
I did a paper on it this semester.
So yeah, no, exactly. It has as much style as the King James Bible, in a way. It's as unmistakable as the King James Bible.
I really like the appendix sections where he just talks in prose.
Yeah, and he, like, goes on little, and he, like, makes fun of Descartes, and he, like, goes on these little side quests. Yeah.
Yeah, he knew that that book would come out after he died. He was not holding back at all.
Yeah, no, and it's just, and he knew he was dying. And he knew he was dying, you know, and he was aware that he was going to die young, that, like, his work would be left after him, that it might not survive even. The ethics was actually assembled by a circle of his friends who were various free thinkers and Quakers, who he corresponded with mostly about Cartesianism and other things, a kind of weird, a weird collection of goofy Dutchmen. And
kind of like Adam Smith was to Hume.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. Huh. I had never thought of that. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and then Adam Smith was like, actually, Hume, I don't want to be killed either just because you die before me.
Yeah. I mean, this is what I mean when I say, like, you know, philosophy happens outside of the university. Like, these guys, none of these people were part of universities. They created these sort of institutions, these kind of vague and unbounded institutions that existed outside of any official standards that were funded by various ways. Like, you know, like, it is, there are many ways to have an intellectual life, and it has been done under harder conditions than we live in right now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, you know, at least we have toilet paper and penicillin, you know, and hopefully nobody's getting torn limb from limb in the street and eaten.
And nobody treats philosophers as a threat anymore.
Except for the right. Except for the right wingers who actually do. And
that's a new recent phenomenon, but we got a little period where nobody thought we were a threat.
The state
does not think we're a threat.
Yeah, that's a good, I mean, depends on which state, but this state, no. You know, France, Macron, with his, you know, every other speech being about, like, le postmodernisme, or whatever, you know, like, this sort of, like, le genre idéologie, like, whatever, like, it's...
He's trying to get Lil Pinker out or something.
Yeah, it all feels very kind of, like, put on and fake. Like, I don't think he actually thinks any of that. He's trying to just steal enough votes away from the Le Pen.
I've always thought Hildegard is the real leader of France anyways.
Who is that?
Hildegard, the mayor of Paris.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, no, it's fucking Macron. And Macron was, I mean, you wonder if philosophy makes you a better person. Macron was the student, and in many ways, like the protege of, I'm so bad with names, Paul Ricoeur.
Oh, yeah.
Of Paul Ricoeur, the phenomenologist and sort of literary theorist. And
yeah, he has a bunch on Verso. Is he the one that has the emancipated subject? Is that him?
I don't know.
Or no, the emancipated specter. I think that might be it.
I'm not sure. I know his big book is called Narrative and Time, which is like a huge two-volume opus. He is a sort of like crypto Heideggerian. It's confused, but like Macron was his protege in a lot of ways. He was his like direct assistant in compiling texts towards the end of his life, and a lot of good it did him. He's doing whatever he's doing. He's the neoliberalizer, and that's how he'll be remembered. It's totally. But anyway, we're way off.
French politics is another episode.
Yeah, it's not something I can weigh in on. I can't weigh in on any of this, really. So wait, where were we? Yeah, Spinoza, right? Like, claiming one's life as one's own. Like, this is where I think the rubber hits the road. Especially with a figure like Deleuze, because
I don't know if there's an academic that believes that philosophy happens outside of academia more than Deleuze.
I know, exactly.
Maybe Guattari, but no, Guattari doesn't count. He was outside of academia.
Yeah, exactly. Guattari was he was running Laborde. Yeah, no, like, I mean, Deleuze, because his major references are always writers. He's fascinated with American fiction in particular because, you know, Walt Whitman had a third grade education. Herman Melville dropped out of the seventh grade because his father was fleeing debt collectors. You know, like there is a massive tradition, especially, I mean, D.H. Lawrence was self-taught. There's a sort of an obsession in Deleuze with the self-taught, with the autodidact, with the minor. And this is what it means to be minor in many ways, right? And I think that the sort of becoming minor bits of, you know, in Kafka and all those sort of like in those books, like in this Proust book, like, you know, there is this. Because what Deleuze likes about these figures is that they don't, and this is where I think the difference between theory and philosophy. I don't think of theory as philosophy. I think of theory as Deleuze says that philosophy is the production of concepts or whatever, right? Like, in what is philosophy? That is how I think of theory. I think of it as the production of concepts that are, in a way, made to stand on their own. Philosophy, I think of as systematic, as sort of deriving, as more geometrico, as Cartesianism, as like that, like, whereas theory is a sort of like, it produces concepts like William Burroughs does, just churns them out, just says shit in some ways, begins somewhere. One has to begin somewhere. And what Deleuze likes about these writers is that they just begin, that they're not shy about it. And from there, sorry, my neighbor is taking the trash out. And from where they begin, he's able to work. He's able to sort of wrap it in, like, into not a system, because I wouldn't say Deleuze is a systematic thinker, though he is more systematic than we give him credit for, probably. Does that?
Yeah, I was kind of referring to, I'm going through the ABC series for Deleuze, because it's all translated on YouTube now with subtitles, and gives me a little bit of practice for French, where I could be like, oh, I understand that when he says maintenant, he's saying now.
Right.
Stuff like that, as I try to slowly become fluent. But I'm in the middle of C'est pour culture. And he's talking about The Fold, because I believe it was his last book at the time. I'm fairly sure it takes place between The Fold and What is Philosophy. So
Right.
God, when would that be? Somewhere between like 89 to 91 or something like that.
That would probably be 91, yeah.
What is philosophy came out after Guattari died in 90, I believe. So, yeah.
I thought it came out like a couple months before he died. I thought What is Philosophy came out in 91. Guattari passes the next year.
Well, he did.
It's very close.
Yeah. Because I know Deleuze wrote most of it. It doesn't really matter, but go on.
But he's talking about the fold at this time. And particularly, he's not necessarily talking about the concepts of the book, but rather he's talking about all these letters he received because of the book. And he's talking about tossing out all the boring ones from philosophers and stuff. And then he got one from like a surfer who was saying that, the waves, the experience of us surfing, that's kind of how I connect to the fold. Mm-hmm. Then he got like children that do, or maybe teenagers that do like newspaper printing. And there were a few other examples, but what was important to him was the kind of aspect that they are outside of this academic, right. I guess, apparatus, that the ability to read this book on what's a philosopher that would have been dead for almost 250 years at that point, if not a little longer. Yeah. A book on that, on Leibniz, just becomes this thing that is grants just surfers, teenagers working a part-time job. Like they all identify with these concepts and are able to apply them to their, I guess, daily life and function. That's kind of the connection I was having, particularly with how you discuss theory.
Yeah, and it gives you a grip on your life. Yeah. No, The Fold is the hardest Deleuze book, and I do not understand a freaking word of it. I do not know what is happening in that book.
Maybe you should go surfing.
No, I shouldn't. I absolutely should not go surfing. I think that intellectual culture in France especially is very different from here. There is a sense that I get from my undergraduates, that I've heard from my friends who are sort of not in academia, but are like, you know, intellectual people in their own way, that the only place you can do serious intellectual work is in the university. This is ridiculous. That is a ridiculous statement. The university is... Not only is the university not the only place you can do serious intellectual work, it is actively much more difficult because there are an infinite number of enticements to do something that is deeply unserious, to use my favorite Twitter insult, to produce a certain kind of boring rote
philosophy of Riverdale.
I love Riverdale. Don't you dare.
I was trying to find a show that nobody loved. But my mind immediately, it was like the philosophy of Looney Tunes. And I was like, I would actually love that book.
No, it's the philosophy of like NCIS.
That's the type of shit I was thinking. I forget those shows exist.
Yeah. Did you know NCIS is about boat crime? It's about crimes that happen on boats.
They're Navy.
What?
It's the Navy crime unit.
I know.
Sometimes they take place off of boats, okay?
It's all boat-based, though. It's boat-centric, even though not all... Anyway, but the point is, like...
20 seasons.
Yeah, like, the point is, like... There is a massive ecosystem of theoretical work happening. There is, there's people like Taylor, who is sort of academia, who translates... And people buy those freaking books. His Machinic Unconscious translation has gone through, I think, like almost a dozen printings. Like, you know, people want to read this stuff, you know, and there is an urge to it. Like, but at the same time, I struggle to understand this because. Yes, you go into work every day. You're at your job for 8 hours. You sit at a desk. You do all this boring stuff. You come home. Your brain is wiped. All you want to do is have a beer
and like hang out and watch some terrible television, whatever. Like, I get that. I do that sometimes too. You know, it's hard to think, but like, what else is there? Like, what else? Like, what else are you going to do with your fucking day?
Chicago, you know? Fire.
There you go. That's the whole Chicago universe. Chicago PD.
No, I have Chicago MD all on TikTok, and the psychiatrist is really fun to watch because he's like, it feels like there's a guy that should be in House that's just in this generic TV show.
No, House is a masterpiece. House was one of the first television shows I ever loved as a kid, and it produced like the hypochondria that I suffer from every day now, which I share with Deleuze, also hypochondriac, for the record.
Well, he didn't have a lung, so.
Yeah, you know. God, I mean, do you think Deleuze killed himself or not?
I remember on Machine Gun Conscious, it was either when I was going to work as a lifeguard in the very early morning or very, like, after it got dark at night, I can't remember. But somebody offered the theory that the people that suffer with Deleuze's, I don't know if it's disease or condition, the people who suffer with Deleuze's condition, occasionally when they get fresh air, they just kind of walk forward or something. Somebody else had a better explanation of it. But
yeah, I believe that.
There's the belief that like it could have been something psychological, not necessarily suicide, but something to do with having his condition for, what, 40 years?
Jesus.
Just people who suffered with that just kind of, not necessarily kill themselves, but end up in an accident that ends their life.
Yeah. No, this is, I mean, because in the same way that, like, we don't remember this now because Deleuze has been so feted by American English departments and stuff. But like when Deleuze died, his suicide was basically used as slander against him, or what may or may not have been his suicide.
Yeah.
In the same way that Fisher, when Fisher died, people like an academic whose name I will not repeat on this podcast posted a tweet after Fisher died. Basically saying like, well, I might be a liberal shill, but at least I'm alive still. You know, just
is it a guy that has anything to do with Heidegger?
Does he have anything to do with Heidegger? Not
if you have to ask the question, the answer is not the guy I'm thinking of.
Not the guy you're thinking of. No, but it's just like
I don't think he's that mean-spirited. Yeah, I just wanted to know.
No, it was an incredibly mean-spirited, nasty thing to say, like about some, you know. But I think that it's a kind of academic resentment against people who Fisher and Deleuze, like, who do not feel constrained by the demands of the academy.
Yeah.
In the way that professional philosophers do. And their response is to call that unserious. And it is, and to me, to my mind, it is pure resentment. In the worst sense, in a sort of life-denying, thought-denying strategy that tries to bring everything in the world down to its level. And yeah, like if most people, you know, most of us are going to start a blog and it's going to suck ass. I have a blog that sucks ass, you know.
So do like, I.
Yeah, like, and that's fine, man. Like, but at least you're doing something.
I hope it doesn't actually suck ass, but it's just basically me philosophical ramblings at 11 p.m. And I'm like, everybody else on Substack's doing these like really detailed articles, and I'm going to feel a bit about this one at 9:30 when I wake up tomorrow.
Yeah, but it's a practice. But that's the whole book. It's a practice. And this is what philosophy is for Deleuze especially, is it is a daily practice. You wake up and you sort of, you know, it's easy to be kind of new agey and annoying about it. Like, it's not yoga or Tai Chi or anything, but it's a way of being in the world that is undetermined, or like that is not undetermined, but more, but less determined than a lot of other ways of being in the world. You know, there's not, and it can be heroic, it can be, or it can be totally humble. Like I just, you know, I fully believe that. What am I trying to say here? Yeah, I get like, This conversation really did not go in the direction I had this whole set of notes about just like what I think theory is and where I think theory goes and what is and is not theory. I had a whole graph where I like named names and called people, but no, like I think this gets to the heart
came
of it.
Here to chew gum and kick ass.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm all out of gum.
Yeah. No. Like. Oh, I'm all out of ass. Oh, you know. It's. In a way, it's what Jameson says. It's a form of writing, and writing is and as Wittgenstein says, a language is a form of life.
Yeah,
right. It's a style through which we move, and you know, I mean, what better answer do we need than that? I mean,
yeah.
Like, you know, should there be a politics attached? Yes. Like, should there, like, you know, do we need to be right thinking people? Like, yeah. Like, I'm not saying like it all, anything goes.
Yeah. That's kind of the hard part after you get to Nietzsche. It's like, okay, well, I've got rid of morals. How do I make sure that we have some constraints now?
I think that requires in some ways like a leap, you know, like a recognition that like the only life worth living is collective.
Yeah.
The only happy life is collective. And I don't mean like in the Hobbesian sense, you know.
It's like the one big thing. Yeah, I remember, I don't know if you ever saw this on Twitter, but it was this egoist anarchist who only read like Nietzsche and Stirner, but the philosophy they got out of it was they should commit as many crimes as possible, including probably like assault, if not murder. Like, it was really bad. Yeah. Did you see that tweet?
This, no, there was a story. I mean, do you, the Leopold and Loeb, have you heard this? There was a pair of, you know, men in their early 20s in like early 20th century who, you know, read Nietzsche and decided that they were themselves the Übermensch and they were going to commit like the perfect crime by like murdering some 11-year-old boy. And they did. And you know what? They got caught in like fucking 4 minutes. Like they got immediately caught.
That was the perfect crime?
Yeah. No,
child murder?
Not perfect enough, baby. You know, because they got so caught by like the Chicago PD, who were not then and are not now known for their clearance record. But, you know, like, no, like there is a totally dangerous... I mean, and like Dostoevsky, right? This is the whole plot of Crime and Punishment. Like, did they not read Crime and Punishment? Like,
probably not. You know, that's too big like, for them.
Yeah, it's fair. Yeah. Yeah. No, I like aphorisms. Yeah. But like, you know, you don't want to say that. You don't want, like, you know, but I guess I'm with Sartre on this point in that, like, this is a totally life denying. Like, you think you're being Nietzschean,
cool and edgy.
Nietzsche would spit on these people, like these freaks in Dime Square. You know, I don't know. Like, I know, like, you know, this sort of like, you know, Red Scare, right? Like New York City, right?
Oh, the people that go so far left that they end up being like a fascist.
No, not even those people. I mean, like
they wrap around, they care about working class issues so much that they become like a right winger.
No, I mean, like, there's a small. If you don't know about this, you're lucky.
I've been to New York twice and it's been on like trips with my school. So I haven't been able to like experience it as like this. I haven't experienced the pretentious culture of New York City. So
there's a small scene of extremely pathetic artists and writers down in Chinatown in the West Village now who
isn't there always
who are trying to make a certain kind of like right wing artistic practice popular. Don't look it up. The point is that like this, there's a certain, like, this is resentment, you know. I mean,
I need to I don't think I should promote it on the podcast while recording, but afterwards, can you send me what it is, because I want to see how bad it is.
Yeah, edit this whole thing. Like, my whole point is like my whole point is like, you know, and maybe this is a totally unphilosophical and untheoretical point, but just, you know, a life of sort of resentment and reactivity, in the Deleuzean Nietzschean sense, is an unhappy life. you know, it's all sad passions, baby.
Yeah.
No, like it does not, like, you know, the only, and in this way, I'm a Lacanian, I think, in that, and a Sartrean, in that, like, I think the only way to move forward is to affirm your life, is to say, this has been done to me. It's happened in the stupid, brutal vortex of contingent material reality into which I've been thrown. I live at this moment in history. I need a map, a cognitive system through which I can understand what's happening to me and to everybody I know and love. And I can act from there.
Yeah.
I can't, you know, I mean, it sounds fucking trite, but, like, you know, I think that almost everybody who comes to philosophy comes to it because they had some version of that experience. That they, you know, philosophy is not, I had a teacher when I was in high school, actually, who said, Aristotle says philosophy is born of wonder. Bullshit. Philosophy is born out of disappointment. It's what happens after disappointment. After the world's let you down, what do you do with that? You start to wonder why.
Yeah.
I believe that. I think that that's as close to a universal statement as we can make. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's a pretty good place to also end on, I think.
Yeah. All right.
I don't want to make it too long. We can continue talking after it's done recording, but I only want to upload so much.
Oh, God. Oh, God. I'm so embarrassed myself. Okay. It's going to be great.
There's like 2 minutes out of this I probably should edit. But yeah, but thank you for coming on. I'd love to have you on again for something else. Maybe not episode 20, but if I do keep the podcast on later on. But to the people on YouTube or Spotify or wherever you're listening to this, thank you for somehow getting to the hour 20 mark. If that person ever exists, thank you. And hope to see you for the next episode.